Good evening, everybody. This is Brittany, and I'm going to be your moderator tonight. I'm here with State Senator Jay Casa, and we want to welcome you to this live telephone town hall. If you have a question for Senator Casa at any time, press star 3 on your phone's keypad. I'll remind you of that a couple of times during our call in case you forget or think of a question later in the program. Now let's welcome Senator Jay Casa.
Well, thank you, Brittany, very much, and I want to thank all the folks who are participating in this evening's telephone town hall. I was mentioned I'm State Senator Jay Casa. And I'm holding this telephone town hall where we can have a conversation about the coronavirus. Now, I have to tell you, we're very fortunate and blessed to have with us a special guest, Dr. Arvind Vinkit, president of the Pennsylvania College of Emergency Physicians. Dr. Vinkit will answer questions you have about the virus, and the format was mentioned that you'll be able to ask these questions by pressing 3 on your phone. So, Brittany, thank you, and Dr. Vinkit, thank you for participating in tonight's telephone town hall.
Happy to be right here, and anything I can do to help, I'm happy to try and help as best I can.
Great.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both. Now, while our calls and our questions are coming in from folks who are live, we got some questions online ahead of time, so let's start with those. Teresa asked, once someone has the coronavirus and has gotten better, can they get it again?
So, Teresa, the answer is that we unfortunately don't have a full answer to that question. We expect that people who've had the virus will generate an immune response, and therefore, if they were to be to get the illness again in the future, it would be much, much more mild. But we don't have all the scientific data to answer that for sure.
All right. Now, we have a call here from Mark, who works at Children's Hospital, has a question about the stay-at-home order. Mark, you are live to ask your question.
Hey, Jay, how you doing?
I'm well, Mark. How are you, buddy?
Good. I work at the facilities boiler plant at Children's Hospital. Do I need a permit to go to work with this stay-at-home thing?
I don't believe you do, Mark. I believe that you are an integral part of the operations of the facility, which is a healthcare facility. So you just need to show up. You don't need any special permission, in my view.
All right, great. I think we're going to get a lot of questions tonight about the stay-at-home order from the governor. Senator Casa, would you like to talk more about that? What activities are permitted versus those that are not?
Well, I think the governor has put into place in Allegheny County as well as a number of counties in southeastern Pennsylvania and also Monroe, and I believe also going to be doing it for Erie County very soon, a stay-at-home order, which essentially means unless you have to travel for very specific purposes like going to the grocery store for your family, or going to the doctors, or going to a pharmacy, things of that nature, or going to work where you're permitted to be someone who goes to work. Otherwise, folks should essentially stay home and to avoid creating a more serious situation by spreading the virus. Our goal and the goal of all of this is to be able to flatten the curve, as they say, or flatten the curve in the sense that we limit the number of people who are exposed to one another that could pass the virus on. But that's pretty much the long and short of it. It's a little different than what other areas are doing. Some folks are looking at doing other types of what I'll call lockdowns. We're not there yet, and that's what I think one of the differences. So we're asked to stay at home as opposed to sort of locking in place, so to speak.
Great. Now, you mentioned something called flatten the curve, and we've seen a lot of that on social media, and we've heard it on the news. But Dr. Vinkit, can you explain what it means to flatten the curve?
So flattening the curve is the term that public health experts use for avoiding a large number of various, very critically ill patients with a particular disease flooding the health system. So in the case of COVID-19, what we are trying to avoid is what happened in Italy, what happened in China, what is probably happening in Iran, and is probably happening in Spain now as well, where there are so many critically ill patients that it overwhelms the health system, which then has a bad impact on the rest of society. So by practicing social distancing, by practicing very careful hand hygiene, we are able to lessen the number of cases that occur at any particular time, so that they occur over a prolonged period of time that we can better handle in the emergency care system.
Great, thank you. Now, Senator, this question I think is going to be better suited to you, but Katie has a question about unemployed Pennsylvanians and what the legislature is doing for them. Katie, you're live. Want to go ahead and ask your question?
Hi, Senator. So a lot of Americans and specifically residents of PA are currently without a job and without a paycheck. And so I'm wondering what the legislators of PA are doing to help those without that have no income right now. And specifically, like, are you looking at halting rent or mortgage payments and or getting a supplementary income for residents of PA?
So there are a combination of things that are going to take place. First and foremost, in Pennsylvania, what we've already ordered are a couple things. We have, through this, working with the Supreme Court, we were able to get them to enter an order that halted eviction notices as well as mortgage foreclosures. So that's one thing that we've done. In the legislature tomorrow, we're very likely to pass legislation making changes to unemployment compensation law that would waive the work search requirement of someone who's receiving unemployment currently or will be unemployed, who is unemployed now and will be seeking benefits. The other thing we're going to do is we are going to get rid of that one-week waiting period. So folks who would be able to collect will be able to collect from day one once they file their claims through the period of time that this situation is in place. We're also not going to hold it against the employer. Sometimes their rating and rates that they have to pay into the Employment Compensation Fund is based on the experiences that they have or claims. We're going to hold them harmless. At the federal level, we're working with our federal folks. I believe that the U.S. Senate package is going to be passing or has passed. We're hoping that they do what needs to be done in terms of extending unemployment. Back in 2008, 9, and 10, when we had our previous crisis, that part of the stimulus program was to extend unemployment compensation from the 26 weeks. We doubled it to 52 weeks. And then I think we did a couple more eight-week sessions. So what we need to do there, working with the state governments across the country, is expand the length and the time that someone can stay on unemployment. So if somebody's on it right now and they're in week 25 and they run out in week 26 and they still can't find work, we need to extend that 26 weeks for them, as well as someone today who goes on unemployment, make certain that we have provisions to allow for beyond the 26 weeks, because what we do anticipate is that this is going to be a lengthy process where a lot of folks are going to be unemployed through no fault of their own. And until they get back on their feet, they're going to need that support. So those are a variety of things that are going to be done. There's also talk at the federal level that they're going to provide about $1,200 to those individuals who are making, I believe, $75,000 or less, $150,000 per family, or filing jointly, to allow them to receive those proceeds, as well as resources, I believe up to $500 for children. So that is yet to come out of the U.S. Senate, and it'll make its way over to the Congress, which I believe they're going to adopt that as we go forward. But those are some of the things, both at the state and federal level, that are being done with regard to unemployment compensation matters.
Great. Now, I want to remind everybody that's on the call, if you have a question now or at any point in our program, you hit *3, and you'll be placed in a short conversation with one of our screeners, and then we'll get you live to ask your question of Senator Costa or Dr. Venkat. Now, Joe and Carrick have a question about blood donations. I'm going to go to Joe next.
Hello,
Joe, you're
Senator.
Live. Go ahead.
How are you doing? Hello?
Yes.
Hello.
Okay, my question concerns the blood donations. If you... If you go to get a blood donation, give a blood donation, what's your chances of transmitting coronavirus to the patient who gets the blood?
So, Joe, there are no cases of blood transmission of the coronavirus. It seems to be transmitted by respiratory transmission, by saliva and spit. Their blood donation is critically important and is extraordinarily safe. And so I would encourage everybody who is willing to be a blood donor to please respond to the community calls for blood donations, because that's been a terrible unintended consequence of this crisis, that we've seen a marked decrease in blood donations. But you will be safe, the person who receives the donation will be safe, and there is no evidence of risk of transmission of the disease via the blood supply.
Okay. Doctor, we have another question for you, sort of on the background and history of this virus. Margaret and Carrick wants to know how the virus got here. So, Margaret, you are live now to go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, I was wondering what you feel the common denominator is of how the virus is spreading. How did it get from China to Europe to the United States? Is it a person? Is it a contaminated item? Is it an animal?
So Margaret, thank you for your question. Any type of respiratory virus will very easily transmit across the world. That's what happens with influenza. It's what happens with other types of coronaviruses, which are much less lethal. There are species of coronaviruses that cause the common cold, which circulate among us on a regular basis. So this isn't something that is attributable to any particular person or to an animal or to a diet or to a contaminant. Unfortunately, when you have a respiratory virus, a virus that is transmitted by cough and saliva, and it's very easily transmitted to people, and it will spread across the world like this one unfortunately has.
All right, now we have some more questions about the stay-at-home order. I'm going to go to Susan. Susan, you're live. Susan, are you still there?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I don't understand how we can keep this shelter-in-place order. I would love to stay at home for 2 weeks and honor the government's wishes, but I have been out for the last 3 weeks trying to get basic cleaning supplies and toilet paper, and I can't get them, so I wind up at the grocery store quite often. I just don't know how you're supposed to honor the government's wishes and still get what you need.
Well, thank you. And that's a question we hear from a lot of folks. We're not in a shelter-in-place order right now. That may change over the course of the next week or so. It remains to be seen how the spread occurs here. We are basically at a stay-at-home. So it's not totally inappropriate for you to go to the grocery store to seek supplies that you need. With regard to the shelves being bare, so to speak, that's something that we have to work with our retail shops, our grocery stores and the like to ensure that they have the appropriate products as they get them in stock.
All right, now we've got a couple of questions along these lines, so I'm going to go to Morgan and Verona here in a second, but a lot of people want to know about the timeline. So Morgan, you are live to ask your question.
Hi, I just wanted to know your opinions on how long you think we will be going through the process of sheltering in place and essentially not having like life as normal.
Well, I can start and I'll have the doctor finish that answer. I just think right now we have it through dependency of the governor's declaration order that's in place, the emergency declaration that's in place. It was for 90 days, and I think we're not anywhere near the end of that. So I expect it to maintain for at least a couple more weeks at a minimum. But the it's really a function of how we avoid spreading this situation, the disease. So, doctor, you want to pick it up from there?
So I think that's a great answer, Senator. And what I would say is that I completely sympathize. My family is struggling with the stay-at-home orders as well, and we find it very challenging. But it's extraordinarily important because of how easily this virus is transmitted and how it seems to be far more dangerous for such a significant part of our population. So I think the answer to the question is going to be a function of how well we all do with social distancing to try and reduce the spread of this illness. That's what is going to accelerate our ability to get back to a normal life.
Okay, now we have some additional medical questions for the doctor here from Mary. Mary, you are live, so go ahead and ask.
Hi, doctor. How are you?
I'm doing well. I hope you're staying safe.
I'm trying. I have a real quick question for you. I'm an ovarian cancer survivor. I'm like 64 years old. I'm relatively healthy, I believe. I do have to go out to the supermarket. Now, I've been using 3 Affinity scarves around my face and mouth. My question is, do you think I'm protecting myself? I'm wearing my gloves. And when I get home, I leave my groceries on the porch for a little bit. How long do you think that I have to leave these things out before any transmission is there from other people touching these items?
Sure. So those are great questions, and I'm glad that you're doing well after your ovarian cancer.
Thank you.
I think there are two important things. One is that when you do go out, maintaining social distancing is very, very important. So as much as wearing gloves and wearing the scarf and how much those protect us is a little unclear, but the social distancing component is very important, and then the hand hygiene component is very important as well. So if you're going grocery shopping and you're picking up fruit or other objects, washing your hand before, washing your hand after is very, very important. And then when you come home, I don't know that you need to leave your groceries out on the porch for a period of time. What I would say is that washing your hands, washing any fresh fruit or produce that you have, wiping off any containers that you've bought, and then washing your hands again and avoiding touching your face is going to be a good way to protect yourself.
Okay, great. Now, we have a question from Elmer. He wants to hear more concretely about the symptoms that everyone should be aware of. Elmer, you're live, so go ahead and ask.
Oh, thank you very kindly. Thank you, Senator Costa, for all the work you do for Pennsylvania.
Thank you. Very kind. Thank you.
I don't know if you remember me, CPHC, but...
Oh, yeah.
The comment I wanted to make was that I think there needs to be more of an outcry, not an outcry, but certainly the posting of the symptoms of the virus so that people can take steps at home to more or less monitor themselves and then begin to self-isolate.
So thank you for your question. The most common symptoms with COVID-19 are fever, cough, body aches, and then a minority of patients get headaches, vomiting, and diarrhea. The problem is that those symptoms are obviously very common and can be seen in conditions other than COVID-19. And so the reason that we need to be careful both in our home and and outside when we have to go out of our house is that you may have symptoms that seem very, very mild, and you may be in the early part of this disease. And unfortunately, there's some evidence that even people without symptoms can transmit this disease in the very early part of their illness. So we really have to practice the social distancing, the stay at home as much as possible, and the hand washing.
All right, great. Now, Chuck in Oakmont has a question about the primary election. I know, Senator, you may have some news to share from today. So Chuck, I'm going to put you live, and you can go ahead and ask.
Thank you, Senator and Doctor. My question is, what provisions are being made in our Commonwealth to ensure that we have an effective primary election?
So what we're doing is tomorrow, the House is going to vote on the measure, and it'll send it to us in the Senate tomorrow, which we will then vote on as well, that would make a series of changes to the election code to ensure that we have an appropriate, safe, and secure election. It won't be on April 28th. It'll be moved to June 2nd. So that'll be the new primary date, and we're doing some other technical changes to make it easier for our election departments to do the canvassing of the ballots and also the mail-in ballots. We're also taking steps to encourage folks to vote by mail-in balloting, which we've allowed for now in Pennsylvania as a result of Act 77. That was passed last year. So it's the combination of moving the election, doing more to work with our poll workers to ensure that they have the time to be trained on our new machines here in Allegheny County, as well as making sure that we do a lot of advertising to encourage folks to utilize the mail-in ballot process.
All right, now we have a question from Brittany, who is pregnant and has a question about how the virus may impact her delivery. So, Brittany, you're live now.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, Brittany, you're live. Go ahead and ask your question.
Okay, hi. Yeah, I've been, like, so worried about everything that's been going on, and I'm, like, close to my due date and stuff. And, I just wanted to know how, like, it will affect the rest of my pregnancy.
So, Brittany, first of all, congratulations in advance. And what I can tell you is that the best evidence we have is that this this disease does not seem to affect pregnant women particularly severely. It's very early data, but the best evidence we have is that pregnant women do fine and their babies do fine. So I hope that puts your mind a bit at ease.
That is good news. Now we have a question from Warren, whose father is elderly and wants to help protect him from the virus. I'm going to put Warren on the line now to ask your question.
Yeah, hi. Some of my questions have just recently been answered. But my father's 94. He has asthma and allergies, so he's always touching his face. So I don't know how I can help him if he gets this virus, you know, how soon I can go in to his house and what instructions you have for him, like, you know, just self-isolating for self-distancing for 3 days or 2 weeks or how long.
So
how long before I can go back into his house?
So thank you for your question. It really depends on whether he has symptoms now or not. If your question is how can you help him to prevent getting this disease, then it's the same advice in terms of social distancing, hand washing, and avoiding touching your face. If he has symptoms of the disease that I mentioned before, because he's older, he is unfortunately at higher risk of developing pneumonia and other complications. And so it's very important for him to be in touch with his doctor, or if he needs emergency care, if he needs to try and call ahead so that we can be prepared to care for him as best we can. In terms of your visiting him and helping him, if you don't have symptoms, then it's okay to go into his house to visit him. I would try to practice social distancing. It's hard with family members in a house to do so, and to be very, very careful to make sure both of you are washing your hands and trying to stay as clean as possible to avoid any transmission that might occur. So I hope that answers your question.
Great, that was really helpful. Now we have a question from Jake in Shadyside, who's a graduating med student. Jake, you are live to ask your question.
Hi, thank you both. Good evening. My question is related to PPE. The graduating class has been in some contact with faculty and staff at Presbyterian Hospital, Shadyside Hospital, Mercy Hospital, and it's pretty unanimous across the board that all, from physician to nurse to PCT, are worried about running out of PPE. And the stockpile is already woefully low. And if our curve is predictive compared to New York or California, we have yet to see most of the bulk of the cases. What is being done at the local and state level to make sure that our healthcare workers are adequately protected with appropriate PPE?
I will start with that because we had a call. I have a call every other day with leaders and the governor and Secretary Levine, and it's a high priority to ensure that we have the resources that that are needed for our frontline folks, particularly our healthcare folks who are dealing with this crisis. I know that they were consistently looking and searching and purchasing items that they need to be able to provide to the frontline emergency care workers, and it's something that I know that they're very serious about. I can't tell you exactly a specific solution to what you're raising, but I do know that that's one of the conversations that are taking place. Doctor, if you can maybe explain exactly what that's referencing, I think that'd be helpful for the listeners.
Sure. So, Jake, thanks and best wishes as you graduate from medical school. But personal protective equipment, or PPE, is really the frontline need at this point in this crisis for the healthcare community. And everybody has been hearing about these specialized masks, these N95 masks, which are used because they filter out the virus. But it goes beyond that to things like gloves, standard surgical masks, goggles, and gowns. all of these items were designed for single use. And we're receiving guidance on the front line as to how to potentially use these for longer periods of time, which is very concerning to the healthcare community. So something that our organization has done, the Pennsylvania College of Emergency Physicians, along with our national parent organization, has been to be very vocal with policymakers, including Senator Costa, who I'm very thankful for his work on this, to make it clear that this is an absolute critical need, that government and manufacturing together has to come together to make sure that adequate supplies are being backfilled into state and federal strategic reserves, and that the supply chains have to be bolstered, because otherwise we're going to run into the situation that has occurred in New York, and definitely has occurred overseas, where there are significant strains on the use of this PPE. Something for the audience to recognize is that as much as there may be an instinct to go out and buy your own N95 mask or your own surgical mask, there is no evidence that wearing those masks, if you don't have symptoms, is beneficial. If you aren't handling those correctly, if you're not putting them on and off correctly, you're in danger for them becoming contaminated and then getting the illness. So one of the things that the public can do is maintain the social distancing, avoid straining the already existing strains on the supply chains, and to allow government and manufacturers to really work with the healthcare community to make sure we have adequate supplies.
One additional thing that we are doing at the state level is normally you have to go through the lengthy procurement process. The benefit of having these executive orders in place and the orders in place allows the Department of Health to go out and purchase the equipment that's necessary immediately from those individuals and entities and companies that have them, so we can get them into the frontline folks as soon as possible. So that's one of the things that we're doing at this point as well, waiving all the administrative and procurement regulations to allow that to occur.
Okay, now Olivia has a question on rent and mortgages and what's being done along those lines as people are out of work. So Olivia, you are live now to go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you so much, Olivia, they, them. Thank you so much for your time. And you mentioned earlier that evictions and mortgage foreclosures are being halted. But once that halt in some point in the future is lifted, folks who couldn't pay during this time are likely to have their housing pulled out from under them. And I'm wondering, you know, with the working class being sent home from work, but the renter class still being allowed to extract rent, what can we be doing? Like, what can the Senate be advocating for? What are you personally advocating for to make sure that in the future these evictions won't happen? And in a dream, you know, to make sure that rent actually just is not being collected during this time, that people can't pay it.
I wish I could tell you that we could prevent landlords from collecting rent. I think that becomes really a function of a landlord's compassion for the situation and the individuals. I will tell you, though, that part of what we're trying to do, the Senate Democratic Caucus is putting together. In fact, we penned a letter to the U.S. Congress today, some of the initiatives that we think are appropriate, and including in that are things that are relating to housing. Not only evictions and mortgage foreclosures or utility shutoffs, things of that nature, but also those individuals who were paying rent and figuring out a way to help them. One of the things coming from the federal government is the $1,200 that I mentioned to you previously. Folks will be able to receive that as a way to help assist along those lines short term. Unemployment compensation would be another way that they'll be eligible for that going forward to help assist on dealing that. That doesn't necessarily address the long-term situation. We have a program in Pennsylvania called HEMAP, Home Emergency Mortgage Assistance Program. We're working now to figure out ways to extend that to be able to work with renters as well. Don't know whether or not we'll be able to get that through in a timely fashion, but those are some of the things that we're looking to do in Pennsylvania.
All right, now back to some medical concerns. Tom and Churchill has heard about some potential new symptoms of coronavirus. I'm going to put him live now to ask a question. Tom, are you there?
Oh, yes, yes. Hello, Doctor and Senator. How are you tonight?
Doing well.
You know what? I had a question.
too. I had heard on the news today about two new symptoms, loss of taste and loss of smell, and the possible, diarrhea. And I was wondering how much truth there is to that.
So it's very new evidence, and a lot of it is coming from our colleagues who are ear, nose, and throat surgeons, that they're getting reports of patients who say that they've lost their sense of smell and taste, and then go on to develop the more typical symptoms of COVID-19, of fever, cough, body aches. Diarrhea is a symptom that's been pretty well recognized that occurs in a minority of patients. We really don't know yet whether the evidence of loss of smell and taste is robust enough to say that's something that we should automatically associate with COVID-19. So it's very early, and it's something we're going to need to get more data on.
All right, thank you for that one. Now we have a question from the business community's perspective. John and Crafton wants to ask about what's being done for business owners. So John, you're live. You want to ask a question?
Hello, everybody, and thank you for this town hall meeting. It's very informative.
Great,
My question to whoever gets it is, as a business owner in Pittsburgh, what do you do, where do you start at if you've never had this happen to you, as far as even a natural disaster with FEMA? Where do the business people start at? Do they come to you? Do you have to fill applications out? Are there companies that you can hire that'll put this all together for you?
I don't know if there's companies that you can hire to put it all together. I will say that one of your places to start would be your state senator, your state house member, to work with you to bring in the Department of Community and Economic Development and the SBA, the Small Business Administration. Together, they're working on a program. We just approved through the CFA and made $61 million available to a group, an entity called PIDA, P-I-D-A. I advise you to maybe go directly to the Department of Community and Economic Development. That's a great starting point, and look for COVID-19 businesses support. And that will be a place where you'll be able to get started. But doing that, I think you should do it in conjunction with your state senator, state house member, and their staff to help walk you through that. And then they can also stay on top of that process for you to ensure that you have available information that will tell you what you might be eligible for. Whether they be loans, it will be forgiven in part because of you're paying employees, whatever the case might be, or no interest loans, or zero, low interest loans, or no interest loans. Also a part of that conversation, depending upon your situation and what you're spending your money on as a business owner.
Okay, now George wants to know about whether we should be sending supplies to areas that have more cases of coronavirus versus those that don't. So I'm going to let George ask it. George, you are live now.
Thank you. Thank you to everybody. I was just wondering if it's been looked into, there are some counties that have no cases. Are there any extra resources there? And are there any extra resources in other states that have no cases? Can they transfer some of their extra PPE here?
I think that those conversations are taking place through the Department of Health and also with our Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency. Together, they are working on an inventory of supplies and supply sharing. That was one of the conversations we had on our call, I believe, on Monday, yesterday. Yeah, and that's one of the things they've been talking about. So there's a centralized location point, so to speak, for the whole Commonwealth with respect to transferring supplies. I get calls every day. This morning, we got a call for the eastern suburbs for cots, possibly for the Monroeville Convention Center. We get calls about respirators. Certainly we get calls and companies that want to help with masks. We prioritize a lot of those and get them to the Department of Health and also to PEMA, who also then coordinates activity along those lines.
Okay, now we're getting a lot of questions from callers as well as some questions online ahead of time about a vaccine, what the timeline is, what the process for developing one is. So I'm going to go to John in Penn Hills, who wants to ask about lifting shelter in place without a vaccine. So John, you're live now. Go ahead and ask.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What I'm thinking about is, you know, we've been looking at this like we have the 90-day order. When that's over, perhaps we can get back to normal. But I can't see the scenario where the shelter in place lifts until we have a vaccine. Could you walk me through what might occur that would allow us to lift the shelter, the self-isolation orders?
So John, I can answer that from a medical perspective. The development of vaccine, the best experts in this, and this, there's been a lot of news about this, is that it's going to take anywhere from 12 to 18 months for a vaccine to be developed. And the reason is that when you're talking about vaccines, you're talking about the highest safety standard, because you're giving a medication to someone in the hopes of preventing them from getting a disease. And our first job is to obviously do no harm. So they're accelerating the testing as best they can, but it's not likely to be effective before 12 to 18 months. Medically, the best expert recommendations from a public health perspective to come out of this is to see that the curve is flattening and that the level of transmission has gone down. And that'll hopefully be coupled with, as we get more testing resources and as we get more information about how widespread immunity is in society as a whole, that can better inform the lifting of these restrictions. Unfortunately, because we don't have widespread testing and because we don't have a full grasp of how quickly immunity is developing in society as a whole, the best public health experts are saying that we need to be restrictive like we are now.
Thank you for that. I want to thank everybody on the line who's asked very thoughtful questions so far. If anyone on the line has a question and you haven't had it asked yet, please hit *3 at any point, and we will try to get to you as soon as possible. I want to go next to David, who has a question about the Spanish flu. I know that's something that we've heard a lot about in the news, so I'm going to let him ask now.
Yes. I was just wondering, how does this compare to the Spanish flu? Flu from 1918.
So it's hard to draw an exact comparison because we obviously have a very different society and a very different healthcare system than we did in 1918. From a medical perspective, the difference between COVID-19 and influenza, and a better comparison might be the H1N1 influenza from a few years back, is that for flu, if I have the flu, the best evidence is that I can transmit it to 1.5 to 2 other people. The best evidence with COVID-19 is that if I have it, I can transmit it very easily from anywhere from 3 to 4 people. The evidence with flu is that it causes death in about 0.1 to 0.2% of individuals. And in 1918, the flu mortality was higher, but again, we had a different healthcare system. With COVID-19, the feeling is that the mortality rate, when all is said and done, may be anywhere from 8 to 10 times higher than what we have with seasonal flu. So more like 0.8 to a little over 1% mortality. So that together is what's causing these restrictions and what makes it different in many ways from previous flu outbreaks that we haven't dealt with in the same way.
Thank you. Now, Nick wants to ask about the tipping point for government to enact more serious approaches. So I'm going to let him ask his question now. Nick, you're live with us.
Cool, thanks. So I'm just looking at the, kind of some ratios here. You got like a population of roughly 60 million people in Italy, and the cases are somewhere around 69,000 if you look at the population of New York State. It's around 20 million, maybe about 25,000 cases. At what point do we say that proportionally this is almost the same as what's going on in Italy, and it's only hit one state so far? Kind of secondarily is like, are we testing in Pennsylvania at the rate that they're testing in New York State? And at what point do we look at all this and say, we need to do more? And what does that look like? What is more?
Well, I can say
Senator,
that. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, please go ahead.
No, you're good, Doc. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think I'd like to think that a lot of this is going to be driven by the scientific evidence, but certainly society is complex, so I think there's a lot of factors that go into how far you go on these restrictions.
And I think it's really a function of not knowing exactly what steps they did take in Italy and other countries, but I know that we have been in Pennsylvania probably more aggressive at the outset than I think the numbers indicated we needed to be, which I think is a good thing. We do know that New York State, for example, and the eastern part of Pennsylvania are have high numbers, but we have to continue to be diligent and working to make sure that we follow the rules and orders that the healthcare professionals put into place for us to recognize how important they are and to move forward. Obviously, we don't want to get anywhere near where Italy has been, but unless we respect the severity of the virus and the orders that are in place, we may get there, but we have to be careful that we don't.
All right, great. Now, Kate has another question about those who test positive and requiring hospitalization. So, Kate in Squirrel Hill, you are good to ask.
Hi. I was informed this morning that I have tested positive for COVID-19, and I was wondering what percentage of those who test positive require hospitalization?
So, Kate, I hope you're feeling better soon. The answer to that is anywhere from 8 to 10% of patients end up requiring hospitalization. But really the most important information is how you're feeling. So the factors that would cause me as an emergency physician to say that you needed to be hospitalized is if you're having worsening shortness of breath, if you're feeling lightheaded or dizzy, if you are not acting yourself. But the advice that I've been giving here and in other places is that if you have symptoms that are similar to what you might have with other viruses, and you feel like you're doing okay and you're eating and drinking okay and staying hydrated and able to go about your business at home, please be careful at home. Try to practice self-isolation to avoid transmitting the disease, but you should be able to avoid hospitalization.
All right, now we have Sharon in Pittsburgh who wants to ask about a physical therapy appointment and whether she should go. So Sharon, you are live now. Go ahead and ask.
Well, hi, Senator Costa. How are you today? And doctor, thanks for letting us listen in and answer our questions. Well, I think that I shouldn't go to my physical therapy session, but I was asking if the facility was going to be open. And they said they got letters to come to work. So are they exempt from coming to work now since the order's been put in? The doctors and the nurses?
I don't necessarily believe so. I got to go back and look at the list to see whether physical therapists, I think that they are part of the healthcare delivery that I think would be necessary. But it may be an office-by-office situation, therapist-by-therapist along those lines. But I do believe that they are permitted to be open. With respect to whether you should go, certainly I think I defer to the doc on this one, but I do think that if you know, social distancing, I'm not sure how you can practice it there, but at the end of the day, you really got to make a determination for yourself.
Yeah, I would add that this is really a discussion to have with the doctor who prescribed the physical therapy for you. Because it's going to be very individualized as to what's the trade-offs for going to physical therapy versus not going to physical therapy. Most healthcare facilities are open because they're considered necessary for the well-being of the Commonwealth. And so all healthcare facilities are being very careful in terms of practicing good hygiene and in a physical therapy environment, cleaning equipment and the like. So I think the best advice I can give is talk to your personal physician about what whether you should go or not.
All right. Now, there was some news last week that ibuprofen may not react well with the virus, and Helena has a question about that. So you are live now to ask.
Hi. Thank you so much for accepting my question. And I'd like to thank the doctor and all of his colleagues and Senator Costa as well for all that you do for us. My question is that I received messages from Europe yesterday that the ibuprofen blocks the respiratory channels, and that ibuprofen increases the number of receptors on which coronavirus can attach. And then we got a message from Italy saying that they believe that's why their fatality rate is so high. And so I wanted to just get your perspective on that and why we're not hearing that in the American news in terms of avoiding the ibuprofen.
So it's a great question, and there's no good evidence that taking ibuprofen makes you worse off in the context of COVID-19 than taking Tylenol for a fever. There is some theoretical data that really there's no great clinical data to say that could be the case. What I will say about ibuprofen is that it's not a great medication in those over the age of 65. And those who might have kidney or liver problems. And so for that population, separate from COVID-19, I think Tylenol is a better medication. But in terms of just COVID-19 specifically, there's really no good scientific evidence saying that ibuprofen is worse than Tylenol.
All right, thanks. So we're going to pivot a little bit and talk about some administrative announcements from the governor. Two questions that we got online. What are the plans for driver's license renewals and real ID, and if there's an update on school closings, what the date is this time? And I think there was some news on that yesterday. Senator, if you'd like to share that.
Yes, on the school closings, the governor announced yesterday that he would extend it for 2 more weeks to allow, I believe, through April 2nd. So the schools would stay closed. But beyond that, we are dealing with legislation in the House today and tomorrow, and then we'll get it tomorrow to refine it, that addresses the ability of our school districts, if they have the wherewithal to do it, to do some online learning possibly, or do some other type of student enrichment through the school district to ensure that the kids that are at home, that they're finding some things to do educationally. So those are going to be some steps that will be approved as we go forward. The 180-day rule, I think I may have mentioned earlier, will be waived, as well as the number of instructional hours and a number of other things. Most importantly, the schools will continue to be reimbursed at the rates they've been reimbursed at, so there won't be a major impact on the funding of our schools. And then beyond that, our teachers and employees in our school districts will be paid as well going forward. As it relates to the Department of Transportation and the motor vehicle license locations, they're trying to exercise best practices. I believe they still are open to allow people to be able to receive their real ID or other type of identification, but they've scaled back a number of things to be able to get folks to comply with the number of folks who are inside the offices at any given time.
All right, one more along those lines. Nancy asked online whether the Pennsylvania tax deadline had been extended beyond April 15th.
Yes, the Pennsylvania tax deadline has been extended beyond, I believe, to July 15th, consistent with the federal change that occurred. But we have not been able to provide legislative authority for our local municipalities to be able to do the same. So your state taxes won't be due till July 15th. Your federal taxes will be due then. But it remains to be seen whether or not we move the local municipal tax collection to another date. There's some who believe that the authority already exists with the local municipalities, but there are others who believe that the authority does not exist. That's why we're going to try to address it legislatively as we go forward.
All right, thank you. And we're going to go back to those who are listening on the phone. Karen has a question about how you qualify for a test and where you can go about getting one. So, Karen, you are live now. Go ahead and ask.
Thank you very much for taking my call, Senator Costa and Doctor, and I didn't quite catch your last name. But anyhow, I am 65. I'm a lung cancer survivor and a chronic pain patient. And first of all, I'm not sure if I have a fever. I don't have the chills or aches or anything other than my normal aches and pains, but because I don't have a thermometer. But I do have a cough and increased issues with my breathing. So would I qualify for testing? And if so, where do I go? And if I do have the virus, what medications are they treating people with?
So thanks for your question. My name is Dr. Venkat. Apologize
Venkat.
If that wasn't Venkat. Yep. In terms of your symptoms and who qualifies for testing, it's really a function of whether your primary care physician feels that you need testing based on your symptoms. If you're having worsening cough and shortness of breath, then certainly that's a concern. Primary care physicians are able to prescribe testing, and then there are locations that are being set up to do that, including here in Allegheny County, including drive-through testing. If you feel like you're getting worse, then I'd certainly encourage you to seek emergency care, and they may or may not test you based on what they think when they see you. In terms of specific treatments, there really are no specific treatments for COVID-19. There are a number that are in clinical trials now, but the care that is mostly provided is what we call supportive care, which is IV fluids, oxygen, medications to break your fever, and treatments to help your breathing. So those are the treatments that we are using in the emergency department and in hospitals today.
More on sterilizing hospitals and cleaning products. Somebody wants to know whether hand sanitizers and wipes are working. So I'm going to start with Young here. You are live to ask the question.
Thank you. I really wanted to know what is the effectiveness of wiping down with bleach and using these hand sanitizers and wipes. Are they really effective? And what is the best way to sanitize after you've had to go out grocery shopping and coming back in?
So the best way to stay safe is actually vigorous washing of your hands with soap and water. Good old soap with water and doing it for 20 seconds. And there are lots of memes on the internet about how to make sure you're doing it for 20 seconds and getting all parts of your hands. That's by far the most effective way to sanitize. The hand sanitizers and the bleach also work. They need to be of a certain caliber. So with the hand sanitizers, they talk about they have to be at least 60% alcohol in content. They work a little bit differently than soap and water, and if done correctly, they're as effective. There are also recipes for if you're out of cleaning sprays to putting a quantity of bleach in water and using that to clean off your counters. And I apologize that I don't have those exact details, but that information is available on a number of reputable websites.
Okay, thank you. Now, we have a couple of questions online and on the phones about how to clean surfaces and how long the virus may last on different types of surfaces. So Lorraine in Forest Hills had some specific questions. I'd like to put her on now to ask.
Hello, and good evening. Thank you. I'm wondering what the timing is that the coronavirus remains on various surfaces, the best disinfectants to use on them, and specifically, now out of necessity, we're ordering so much online. So we have packages being dropped at the front door, which are in cardboard and plastic bags, as well as the U.S. mail in general. How should we be handling these items?
So there have been a lot of studies that are out there saying that the virus can last for long periods of time on solid surfaces, whether it's cardboard or metal or paper or counters. Most of those studies were done in controlled environments, and they don't really tell us about whether when the virus is there on the surface that it still is infectious, that if you touch that and then touch your face and it gets into your respiratory tract that you can develop an infection. What I would say is, and what I practice in my home, is that we wash our hands before we handle these items. We try to open them carefully and, if necessary, wipe them down, and then wash our hands immediately after and be very conscious not to touch our face or eyes to try and avoid this. But there isn't a lot of evidence that just from the virus being on surfaces that is what's spreading the disease. And in terms of what's the most effective cleaners, I'd say that most household cleaners are going to be very effective as long as you're very thorough in terms of cleaning off your counters.
Thank you. And I know we talked about this a little bit earlier, but we're getting some additional questions on unemployment compensation. So I'm going to put Mary Kay on the line here to ask some of those. And I think they may answer some of the questions that other folks on the line have as well. Mary, you're live now to go ahead and ask.
Yes. Hello, Senator Costa. I have a question. Hi. I have a question regarding a segment of the workforce that does not seem to be being addressed, and that is the people who are self-employed. My son-in-law is one of those. He went from on Thursday to being employed to now having zero income because he does flooring, and he can no longer do that. What is being done for this segment of our population who are self-employed or subcontractors who do not qualify for unemployment compensation?
So one of the things we're trying to do is to allow those individuals, regardless of whether they pay into the workman's compensation fund or not, unemployment compensation fund, to allow them to be able to participate in the unemployment compensation program. We're looking for guidance and support and authority from the federal government as well, but also Pennsylvania is looking at doing it regardless of what they do at the federal level. So it's something that we're not permitted to be able to do through the unemployment compensation right now, but something we were working on. Those individuals, though, would be allowed to be able to receive the federal stimulus check that's coming to the individuals and families through that process. And finally, the Small Business Administration, working with our PETA department at the Department of Community and Economic Development, has a program where they're doing low-interest loans and some instances no-interest loans to be able to assist individuals who are dealing with the issues that you're talking about.
Okay, great. Thank you for that question. That did, I think, answer a lot of questions we've gotten online and from some other callers. Now, Lisa wants to know about what the state can do if federal regulations and precautions are relaxed. So I'm going to put Lisa on the line now to ask that question.
Hello, Senator Costa and Doctor. Yes, I have a concern about that because, as I saw today, President Trump is wanting to start the economy back and is, you know, go back to business as usual. And at the rate that this virus is spreading, I have a serious concern about that because I myself have underlying health conditions as well as my husband. And also, okay, with the homeless population, and we have a lot of empty places sitting available, say, like closed schools, if it gets to the point, if necessary, would there be something made available for those places to be open, say, like to the homeless or people that may also be displaced? Because if it goes on any longer, what would be done?
With regard to your first concern, I think regardless of what occurs at the federal level, Pennsylvania retains the ability to, and the governor does, do emergency declarations and emergency orders, both he and the Department of Health Secretary, to execute orders that allow for some of the things that the governor and Secretary of Health have been doing. I think that those type of things will be able to continue, even if the economy, the president sends people back to work. Pennsylvania still has the ability to self-govern along those lines, and I believe that's what will take place. If the governor and the secretary don't believe it's appropriate for us to restart our economy as it's been described, then I don't believe that they would do that for Pennsylvania residents, and I don't think they have to either. With regard to homeless individuals or folks who are being displaced, I know that is a concern. Homelessness in Pittsburgh and Allegheny County has been an issue for a little while now. We've been working closely with the mayor's office in Pittsburgh as well as the county executive to develop shelters that allow for to address those issues. And we're trying to expand the number of shelter opportunities for folks, more importantly now than we have been paying attention to it previously.
Okay, thank you for that answer. Now we've gotten a couple of questions about masks yet again and how to protect particularly elderly folks who don't necessarily have the virus but are worried about being at risk. So I'm going to put Barbara on the line. She's got a question about grandmother taking care of younger children. So Barbara, you're on the line now.
Yes, my question, I have maybe three in one. My question is, if you have like elderly grandmothers who are taking care, the kids are being placed in their home. So what do they do if they have no one else to take care of the kids? The kids will have to be in the home with them. And they're at risk of catching the virus because of age or chronic illness. And I'm wondering why the state hasn't, like, designated tests for the ones that are more vulnerable of catching it. And the other thing is telling people to stay home, and they may have it and can die at home because they don't know when to go into the hospital. So that's my question. And the other thing is, like the other lady touched on, we don't know how bad this virus is going to be. So why aren't we setting up hospitals in these vacant buildings now? Because if it comes back in the fall and hit us heavier, what do we got to cover ourselves with?
Well, with the latter part of your conversation, there have been conversations about, through the Department of Health, Secretary Rachel Levine, and other leaders in the regions about looking at convention centers that were mentioned, looking at renting hotel space, maybe housing our doctors and nurses in hotels, finding other ways to be able to make space available to treat folks. So that will continue. That conversation will continue as our numbers continue to grow. With regard to specific testing for adults and how to have adults deal with young children in the home, I'm going to defer to Dr. Venkat to be able to address that.
Yeah, and I wish I had a great answer for you because it is very hard. Obviously, kids are going to be kids, and we do have to be very careful if you're an older person in terms of the risks of contracting this disease. I think you have to do the best you can in terms of trying to be as clean as possible and insisting on hand hygiene, but I don't have a perfect answer for you on that one.
Okay, now we have a call from a younger constituent, Aaliyah, here, who wants to know how the virus compares to the common flu. So Aaliyah, you're live now. You want to ask your question?
I'm a fourth grader at Divine Mercy Academy, and I would like to know, is the coronavirus a very bad case of the common flu?
So it's a great question. So coronaviruses are different from flu viruses, and this particular coronavirus seems to spread more easily than the common flu virus, and seems to cause more harm than the common flu virus, especially to those who are older and who have other medical conditions. So that's how it's different from flu.
Okay, now we have a question from Bob about whether autoimmune diseases make coronavirus worse for a patient. So Bob, you're live now. You want to ask your question?
Yes, Dr. Venkat. That's not exactly the question. My question was, for the very small percentage of people who get into severe respiratory difficulty with flu in the lungs, edema, and an extreme, like an inflammatory response, could this actually be almost like a secondary disease consequence that would represent an autoimmune response to the coronavirus, as opposed to the great majority of people who have more of simple upper respiratory or flu-type symptoms? And what would the implications for treatment be if that was so?
So it's an important question, and a lot of the medical literature that has come out seems to indicate that for that population that gets very, very sick, it's a combination of the virus itself as well as the immune system's response to the virus that goes overboard. So there are trials to try and modify the immune response, but this is all very early going to see if that'll be effective in saving lives. We really don't know the answer to that yet.
Okay, thank you for that one. That answered a few questions, I believe. Now, we have a question on the phone here from Mike about the lag in information coming from the Department of Health. So I'm going to put Mike on the line here to ask a question.
Yeah, hi, and thank you for having this town hall. Question was relating to the Department of Health providing updates daily on the number of confirmed tests and negative tests, and also the deaths by county, saying that there is likely a lag for the reporting. It's not actually showing the spread yet, as we're kind of catching up with the people who have it, who are getting tested, and the tests are coming back confirmed. How current do you think the information is, or when do you expect to be able to kind of see the data reflect more closely the spread of the disease, or the spread of the infection?
Well, I don't know if the data is real-time data. When the secretary will do her briefings, either at noontime or sometimes 2 o'clock each day, and sometimes other times, they are within 8 to 10 hours of information. I can tell you that. I know that for a fact. I think it's 12 o'clock and noontime is when they release that information, what they've collected from the previous day or previous early hours. It's partly a function of what the counties are reporting back to the Department of Health in some instances, and what the hospitals and the like are reporting as best they can. But in terms of when the Department of Health receives that information, they don't hold it very long. It's the next available briefing that they provide that information.
And the only other thing I would add is that we don't have widespread testing. So that's why it's taking longer to run these tests than anyone would like. There is a faster test that was just approved by the FDA that they're hoping to roll out by the end of the month, and that will hopefully allow wider testing, quicker testing, and we'll get better details of what's going on.
Right, now I want to remind everybody on the phone, if you have a question, hit *3 at any point, and we will try to get to you. We've got about 20 minutes left here on our program, and we're going to get to as many of you as possible. But if we don't answer your question, please stay on the line, leave it in the voicemail, and we'll get back to you from Senator Costa's office as soon as possible. Now, Tony on the South Side has a question about workplace safety, particularly about sort of second-degree exposure. So I'm going to let Tony ask his question now.
Hey, good evening. Thanks for taking my question. A coworker's spouse was hospitalized Saturday and came back as positive for COVID-19, and that coworker was at work yesterday. Just wondering, like, going forward, the guidelines for workplace cleanliness, you know, they already cut us back to 32 hours a week, and the companies from out of state, and they're saying if you're not comfortable coming to work, that it would be up to the state of PA for unemployment because work is available and scheduled.
So on that front, I'm not quite sure how the Department of Labor and Industry will handle that particular workman's unemployment compensation request. I do think that it is important to certainly file a claim for the lost wages and hours. And I do believe that in this crisis, we will be more liberal in terms of our interpretations. I can't speak for the Bureau or the Unemployment Compensation Board, but I do believe that the intent is to be as supportive and liberal as possible with respect to those type of claims. With regard to the secondary transmission, I would defer to the doctor.
So a lot of what's being done is to test close contacts of those who've tested positive for the virus. So the first thing I would say is that your colleague should be tested, and I would imagine that the Department of Health is mandating that he or she be tested to be sure whether he has the virus or she has the virus or not. In general, the recommendations that I'm most familiar with, which is for the medical community, is that if you develop symptoms, you need to self-isolate at home, and that self-isolation ends if you are at least 7 days from when the symptoms started, and you've had at least 3 days without having a fever, and that means without treatment with Tylenol or ibuprofen as well. So, and under those circumstances, you can go back to work as a healthcare worker with a face mask on. But that's really the most familiarity I have on this issue.
All right, now Lynn has a question about what happens when we go back to work and children are going back to school. I'm going to put her on the line now. Lynn, go ahead and ask your question.
Yes, gentlemen, thank you. It is my understanding that we are going to be 12 to 18 months before we have anything that's really going to help with this. And I've also heard that the curve is expected to occur, the peak of the curve is supposed to occur around July or August. How are we going to flatten the curve if we are going to send people back to work? And maybe as important, if not more important, we're going to talking about sending our children back to school mid-April. How do we flatten the curve under those circumstances?
Well, I think by honoring and respecting the virus itself and the severity of it, but also adhering to the governor's orders. And I will share with you, I do not believe the governor would put our kids and our Secretary of Health would not put our kids in jeopardy by sending them back to school too early. I don't expect that the April 2nd date is going to be a date that they'll be going back to school, but or whatever the date might need to be, April 6th or 7th, I apologize. I don't anticipate that happening, but I will say that we will continue to monitor the way things are moving and progressing until we get to a point where we have flattened the curve and we're relatively on the backside of the curve that makes it safe to be able to have people back into the workforce and, if need be, back into our classrooms.
All right, thanks. Now, Josephine has a question. She is an office worker who will continue to work but wants to protect her family from spreading the virus with them. I'm going to put Josephine on the line now. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, Josephine, you're live.
Hi. Thank you so much for answering these questions. I work in an office with about 5 to 7 essential people at the moment. I wash my hands a lot. We pass papers to each other throughout the day, but try to stay away from each other. I wash my clothes when I go home. I have a multi-purpose Lysol cleaner that I try to get all surfaces that I've touched with. And I do actually happen to have some access to some N95 NIOSH masks and a handful of medical masks as a total fluke in the back of our cupboard. What are the most important things that I should be doing to just keep everybody safe involved?
So it sounds like you're doing everything right. And so thanks for being so diligent about this. I really don't have a lot of other suggestions other than to be very conscious about avoiding touching your face and hands or touching your face and eyes unless you've been very careful about washing your hands first.
All right, good tips. Now we have a call from Catherine who has some big plans in May that she wants to know whether the gathering rule will be lifted. So, Catherine, you're on the line now.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. I'm supposed to get married at the end of May, at the very end, and I know the CDC released a guideline saying no gatherings of 50 or more for 8 weeks. That's 2 weeks before my wedding. Is it possible that that will get extended and I'll have to completely cancel and move my wedding at this point?
Yes. Well, good luck and congratulations on your engagement. But I wish I could tell you that I definitively could say that that gathering requirement or restriction would not be lifted. We don't know at this point in time. Again, it goes back to a function of whether Pennsylvanians honor and take seriously the restrictions that have been put in place by the orders that Governor Wolf has put into place as we move forward. I know that they were CDC recommendations for 8 weeks, but we could be less, we could be more. It's just too early to tell right now. So I'm not sure what to tell you at this point, but I think stay tuned as we go forward and as we get probably into May, as we get through April and into May, I think we expect to be in a different position than we are today, hopefully on the backside of this curve, and that will determine what we do going forward.
All right. Well, Catherine, I certainly hope you can go ahead with your wedding as planned. Now, we're getting a couple of questions about let's see, actually, we have a bunch of questions still about recommendations for being tested. So I'm going to go to Becky in Hazelwood. Let's go over that again. Becky, can you go ahead and ask your question now?
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Acosta and Doctor, for taking my question and having this town meeting. I want to know, we're told that testing is available at various sites, some of which you don't need a script, but I would like to know what the current recommendations are as to who should be tested, because first it was said if you had symptoms that you should get tested, whether by doctor's script or just going over to, I think, the zoo or some of these different places where you didn't need a script. But the last I heard yesterday was if you have mild symptoms, they request that you don't get tested so as to keep the testing for people that are, a lot sicker, and also to not have people have to use their, the masks and the gloves and everything, trying to conserve them. So my question is, what are the current recommendations as to who should be tested? Thank you.
So the current recommendations are those who are sick enough that they may require hospitalization or treatment in an acute setting. So if your symptoms are bad enough that you need to be in an emergency department or that you might be hospitalized, or if your doctor feels that you have underlying medical conditions that put you at particular risk. Healthcare workers and other frontline workers are also prioritized, and then those in contact with people who have been diagnosed with COVID-19 or who have come from particular hotspots. I think where some of the confusion has come up is that I, the emergency medicine community, the Secretary of Health, the Department of Health, has rightly been messaging that one of the things we want to avoid is using the emergency department as a testing site for those that have relatively mild symptoms and those who are understandably anxious. The danger with coming to the emergency department is that it's a crowded environment where you might then expose those who are particularly vulnerable to this disease to the virus. So the advice that is being given, which I think is the right one, is that all of us know our bodies individually. If you are having symptoms that you would not normally seek acute care, except for the fact that the COVID-19 disease exists, so if you're having viral symptoms that you say, I'm feeling okay, I don't feel great because I have a virus, but I'm feeling okay, then it's better to ride it out at home. Those recommendations may change as we get more testing resources.
All right, thank you for that. We have a couple of questions now about whether someone can be contagious without symptoms, how long someone might be contagious. Hope summarize some of those questions here from Penn Hills. I'm going to put her on the line now. Hope, you want to ask your question?
Hi. I wanted to know, can someone be contagious before they have symptoms? And if so, should we be avoiding the elderly unless absolutely necessary?
So the answer to the first part is that there is some evidence that people who are early in their illness may be contagious, the degree to which is unclear. In terms of avoiding the elderly, it's a very complicated question. We don't want to expose those who are vulnerable to this illness, but we also don't want to abandon people, and that can result in more harm than good. I see plenty of patients in the emergency department who, because they weren't checked on or didn't have a connection with others, ended up getting very sick, much more sick than if we had caught it early. So my best advice is to use common sense. If you're having symptoms of a viral illness or if you feel something coming on, then absolutely you should avoid elderly relatives and friends. If you're feeling okay and you normally check on someone who's elderly, be very cautious about it. Wash your hands, make sure you maintain your social distancing, but please do maintain that contact because that's very important as well.
Okay, thank you. We have some questions now about grocery stores and whether the governor or local municipalities can limit the number of items purchased by each individual. So I'm going to go to Gary, who has that question. Gary, you're live with us now. You want to ask?
Yes, it's kind of obvious that when you go in a grocery store and you go to the meat department or bread or whatever, that the shelves are empty. And I don't believe it's because the product is not available from the store. I think it's the store allowing people to hoard
items and fill up grocery carts full of meat and other products that other people could be using that they wouldn't normally be taking in this situation. Is it possible the governor could set up, could set a demand to the the grocery stores and the retailers to only allow certain items, I mean, not certain items, but a certain amount of each item to be taken per adult shopper?
No, probably not going to be able to do that at the end of the day. That's really a function of the individual store owners being able to place limitations on the number of purchases. You know, the distribution of food across the Commonwealth and across the country is extremely limited right now. So I wish that that would be something that people would be respectful of, whether it be meats or vegetables, or whether it be, you know, the wipes, the Clorox wipes, or whatever the case might be, hand sanitizers. Unfortunately, we don't have the ability to do that. It's also, though, important to know that if these entities or companies are hoarding these type of products, particularly the hand sanitizers and the Clorox wipes, that there are some repercussions along those lines as well. And I think people need to understand that. Certainly the Attorney General has been very aggressive in looking for and looking and addressing these type of price gouging situations across the Commonwealth. So that also is something along those lines we have to be cognizant of as well. But hey, people should respect one another and be able to give somebody something to be able to do along those lines.
Okay, now we're down to about our last 5 minutes. I want to get to one or two more questions. First, Carla in Penn Hills wants to know what symptoms are the most important or the most critical. So I'm going to put Carla on now to ask her question.
Hi, thank you for taking our call. I had a question because my mother is 65 and she's diabetic. She has been having some symptoms, but not all of the symptoms. Like, she doesn't have a fever, but she has had some shortness of breath, a little bit of, like, lightheadedness, more, like, upset stomach, and a slight cough. And she went to try to get tested, but there weren't enough tests available at the site that she went to. So I'm just wondering at what point, with her symptoms, should I consider taking her to the hospital if that seems like something necessary to do?
So it's hard for me to say over the phone. What I would say is that you and your mom obviously know each other best. If you feel like she's getting worse, then I would certainly urge you to seek emergency care. I would try to call the emergency department where you're going ahead of time so that they are as prepared as possible for when she and you arrive. Otherwise, I would say to talk with her primary care physician. And there is rapidly increasing testing resources. So if she wasn't able to get tested before, if her doctor recommended that she get tested, then certainly that opportunity should be there still.
All right, thank you for that one. Now we have some additional questions about the stay-at-home order. Evelyn has a daughter at Carnegie Mellon, and she's got some questions about what the order means for her. Evelyn, you are live now. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, I'm calling to see about the stay-at-home order because there are still students at Carnegie Mellon and like 300 to 500, understanding that they do need, you know, service and they need to be taken care of. But as far as the stay-at-home order, unless the company itself is telling the people to stay at home, people are afraid that if they stay at home, they'll lose their job. And at the rate that Carnegie Mellon is deciding to shut down as much as they can, the people are out of the offices, this is true. But the I'm going to call them service people, are still required to be there. There's been a couple cases since the stay-at-home order, or no, prior to the stay-at-home order, and they were supposedly off campus, but yet they're still quarantined areas. So the stay-at-home order, how does it actually work?
The stay-at-home order applies to those individuals, applies to the Allegheny County as a whole, to those individuals who live there And if they're not essential personnel going to and from their work or doing their work, and they should basically be staying at home. If you have students at CMU in the dorms, they would have to comply as well. If they're required to go to work and they work at a place that is an essential place or a life-sustaining place that's been granted either the ability to stay open or granted a waiver, they should report to work, but also express the concern that they have to their employer. And if they feel they don't need to go to work or don't want to go to work, they should express that. And then we will work on the unemployment compensation side if, in fact, they're not paid for going to work. I hope that answers your question.
All right. Thank you for that. And it's 7 o'clock now, so we're at the end of our time. Senator Costa, do you want to close us out?
Well, thank you very much. I really want to thank Dr. Vanket for his answers and spending time with us on the phone tonight, answering the many questions of constituents of the 43rd District. It's very much appreciated, and people are concerned, certainly, about this virus and your ability to provide them some assurance on some of the things that they asked you and some professional opinions in that regard. Thank you very much. I also want to thank all of our listeners who participated in today's town hall. If you didn't get a chance to have your questions answered, stay on the line, and our folks will capture your information and get an answer out to you very quickly, as best we can. But thanks, everyone, and I appreciate you all participating. And thank you, Brittany, for moderating tonight's telephone town hall.
All right. Thank you again, everybody, for participating, especially Senator Costa and Dr. Vanket. If you have additional questions or concerns, you can always call Senator Costa's office directly at 412-241-6690 or visit his website at senatorcosta.com. There you'll find information on legislation, news in the community, and there's a whole page now on COVID-19. You can find that at senatorcosta.com/COVID-19. So thank you all again. You've been a great audience. Thank you for sharing your evening with us. Mm-hmm.